For those of you that don't know me, my name is Joe Salvo. I have the privilege of standing before you as the current president of the Copyright Society of the U.S., one of the co-sponsors for today's event, along with my dear friend and colleague Jeff Liebenson, who will be up here in a second, from representing the International Association of Entertainment Lawyers. And Jeff has been instrumental in getting us our wonderful speakers this afternoon, so many thanks to Jeff for that. Since there are a lot of, first of all, welcome back to all the friends and old faces in the audience, meaning members that have been members in the past. That's not a comment on age. But also a warm welcome to those of you that are joining us for the first time. For those of you that are not familiar with the Society, we were founded back in 1953. The Society and I are both sharing a 60th birthday this year. It is a wonderful organization. It was set up, founded on the notion, we're a nonprofit, founded on the notion of advancing the understanding of copyright and advancing the dialogue around copyright issues. Our members, we have over 1,000 members nationwide. We have chapters in most of the major cities. And we do a great number of programs during the year. And in a sec, I'm going to bring up the co-chairs for the New York chapter here, who are responsible with Jeff for putting together today's program. So without further ado, I will bring up our New York co-chairs, Craig Mendy and Matt Moore, who have just done an absolutely phenomenal job, and we've got some great programs coming up they'll tell you about.
Thanks a lot, Joe, and thanks everyone for finding your way over here. Just a couple of very quick announcements, and we'll actually, if the panelists want to start settling in, that's fine. The first announcement is that the next luncheon is going to be presumably back at the Princeton Club. It's on the Meltwater case and related cases on content aggregators and why AP likes to sue them. That's scheduled for October 24th, and there will be an announcement to everybody on that. And then I just wanted to introduce this year, new co-chair for this year, Matthew Moore from BMI, who a lot of you know, but I'm absolutely delighted to have him on board.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks. I'm very honored to be able to serve the New York chapter and look forward to a great season of events. And I'd also like to thank Alexander Grout, who helped organize this panel, and special thanks to Josh Graubert, who also put a lot of work into bringing this panel to you all. Thanks also for making it to the Yale Club, despite the last-minute change to this venue. We did that to keep you on your toes, which is also the intent of this next panel. So through the lens of digital music, this panel presentation will address how copyright licensing in the European Union differs from U.S. practice, and how copyright licensing developments in Europe have impacted digital content delivery across borders. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jeff Liebenson, who is a longtime Copyright Society member and is currently serving as the first American president of the IAEL. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Welcome, everybody. The IAEL is very pleased to be presenting this panel today in conjunction with the Copyright Society. I'd like to thank Joe Salvo for his insights in making this happen, and Josh Graubart and Craig Mendy, Matthew Moore, Amy Nickerson, all the people that helped to coordinate this and bring together people from four cities on two continents to share their views with you today. The IAEL has 300 members, and we're around the world. It's very helpful in our practice when international issues come up to be able to call on your colleagues in the IAEL and get expert assistance in different markets. We meet annually at Meetum every year, which is in the south of France, and it's a great place to meet with other lawyers and clients from around the world. We put on legal panels and workshops, and we publish an annual book. I see a couple of people here in the audience that have contributed to our books. This year, our volume is going to be called Licensing of Music from BC, before the change, to AD, after digital, which I think will be of interest to many of you in the music industry. Now, Let's say you represent a U.S. digital music service that wants to seek growth in the international markets. You've licensed the rights in the U.S., but how does it differ in Europe? And what do you need to know to get it done? We're very pleased to have brought together today a panel, a very distinguished panel of experts, each of whom has come some distance to share their views with you. We have, to my left, Alexander Ross from Wigan, the media and entertainment firm in London. Alexander heads up the music and publishing teams at Wigan. He advises record labels, publishers, and digital services. He's a member of our executive committee at the IAEL, and Alexander coordinates and moderates our annual legal update every year at MeetM, which gives our members valuable insights into all of the most important developments, legal developments in our field around the world. Eric Laveau, to Alexander's left, is co-founder and partner at Nomos in Paris, where he's head of the media and entertainment department. Eric has served as past president of the IAEL and currently serves on our executive committee. And at the far end of the table, Lee Knife, who is the executive director of DEMA, the Digital Media Association in Washington, D.C. DEMA represents many of the top digital media companies such as iTunes, Google, Rhapsody, Microsoft, and others. Lee knows all sides of these issues, having worked at several labels in the record industry. He's now engaged in legislative and lobbying efforts and negotiations and arbitrations on behalf of the digital platforms. Lee also is a past contributor to our IAEL books and presentations. So I'd like to start with a brief history of how we got into the current situation and set the stage for our discussion today. Like the U.S., each country in Europe has its own national copyright law. Traditionally, rights holders administered their rights on a country-by-country basis. And back when most music services operated in a single country, that worked quite well. However, with the arrival of the internet, which enabled services to operate on a cross-border basis, people were seeking more multinational licensing approaches. And in 2000, the collection societies in Europe adopted reciprocal representation agreements for the online world through what were known as the Santiago Agreement for performance rights and the Barcelona Agreement for mechanical rights. These agreements authorized the collecting societies to grant non-exclusive, multi-territorial licenses for the online exploitation of musical works. The societies notified these agreements to the European Commission for validation, but in 2004, the Commission considered the agreements to be a restrictive barrier to the creation of a single European market against Article 81 of the European Union Treaty. And the Commission found that the national exclusivity clause of the agreements would improperly preserved the exclusivity of the societies in each of their domestic markets, as well as a favored nation clause, which helped to enforce the rights. The Santiago and Barcelona agreements were terminated, even though they were an initial effort to develop a one-stop shop for licensing. Then, in 2009, the EC issued a key ruling in what is known as the CSAC case. This arose when RTL, the European broadcaster, applied for a pan-European license from GEMA, the German Authors Society, and that request was refused. The Commission ruled in favor of RTL, holding that the traditional reciprocal representation agreement signed by the CSAC collection societies were anti-competitive because they limited the ability of the collection societies to offer their services outside of their domestic markets. The Commission encouraged rights holders to be able to authorize a single society to administer the online use of their works across Europe. So, what have been the consequences of this? The CSAC ruling prompted the European societies to revise their membership rules and to liberalize them. And this was expected to result in the emergence of a small number of powerful collection societies that would dominate pan-European licensing. However, the large music publishers reacted by taking greater control over their repertoires and the management of their rights, and they created new licensing bodies that would control their own repertoires. So first, EMI formed a joint venture with PRS in the UK and GEMA in Germany called CELOS, and it pulled out certain rights for its Anglo-American repertoire, all the online rights, and they deposited them in CELOS and gave them the sole right to authorize those rights. The other major publishers soon followed in similar manner. And since these pan-European arrangements license only part of the overall repertoire, a digital service that wants a complete catalog has to deal with all of these entities, as well as each national collection society across Europe for the remaining local repertoire. So the effect has not been to streamline, but in fact to fragment the entire licensing process in Europe, much to the consternation, I'm sure, of the European Commission. And European licensing of musical compositions in particular, it's been referred to as chaotic and a licensing labyrinth. So in 2011, the Commission engaged in its latest effort to streamline the licensing process by issuing a proposed directive overhauling collection society procedures and permitting only the societies that achieve those administrative goals to engage in multi-territorial licensing. So with that as a background, let's get to the current state of play in European digital licensing. So, in the U.S., the rights to reproduce, distribute, display, and publicly perform are implicated whenever a digital music service features downloads, streams, lyrics, cloud service. However, it's different in the UK and in continental Europe, where we hear about communication to the public and making available and other rights. And the European directives typically refer not only to copyright, but also to other or related rights. What are the small but important differences between our law here in America and that in Europe? Alexander, can you please start off explaining what are the key legal rights for distribution in the UK and how they differ from the US? And then Eric, I'd appreciate if you could do the same for continental Europe.
So in the European Union, our copyright laws were to some extent harmonized by the what some people call the InfoSoc Directive, I generally call the Copyright Harmonization Directive. It didn't by any means achieve total harmonization, nor was it intended to. But what that directive did, 2001, was introduce the concept of communication to the public. And communication to the public becomes the centerpiece of all digital services. And communication to the public is effectively any form of remote transmission from party A to a remote party B, be it electronic or not. And in practical terms, it can be divided into two types of transmission. One is broadcasting, a direct linear transmission, determined at a time by the sending party, i.e. the broadcaster. And on the other hand, a mutually exclusive right, which is known as making available, which is the right to make something available on a website. Whether or not anyone actually accesses it, the right is engaged at the point at which the copyright is made available on the website. And that is called the making available right, but both the broadcasting and the making available right are subsets of the communication to the public right. So any digital service which offers, whether it's a stream or a download, a full download or a temporary download, is exercising the communication to the public right. It's also, of course, making copies in the process of doing that, known as mechanical right on the publishing world, and known as the dubbing right, certainly in the UK, in the recorded world. And just finally on that point about related rights, this is the difference that exists between, as it were, Eric and on the continent and us in England. that we think of copyrights as all having the same value, whether it's a sound recording or a film or a song or a book. They have exactly the same value. We think of them as true copyrights. In the continent, they don't. Eric will explain more. They're known as the what I call the business copyrights. Sound recordings and films are referred to as neighbouring rights or related rights.
Eric?
Yes, it's as you remind, indeed, we have still national laws, national statutes in Europe, and different laws applies to different countries. So in France and generally in continental Europe, we do not have the notion of copyright. We have two different notions. The first one is the notion of author's right, where you have an author. This right is attached to a physical person, maybe licensed, transferred, but it is attached to this person. And you have the neighboring rights. The neighboring rights have been introduced in Europe from the Rome Agreement in the 60s and in France in 85. Neighboring rights, you have two categories of right owners. First one are the performers, and the second one are the producers. And these rights are differently managed. We will probably come to this issue later, but we have this first difference. The second difference we have with UK law is that in France and in several countries in Europe, we have not implemented the directive precisely because we have considered that 4 years the rights have been protected in France and that we did not need to introduce new rights. So one of the reasons why we have not introduced new rights is that these rights are personal to the writer, to the author, and if we recognize a right to the writer, it has not been assigned to the publisher 50 years or 70 years ago, and the publisher won't have the making available right. So this is one of the reasons why in France we have not introduced these new rights, and we are still living with two different rights. First one is reproduction, including mechanical reproduction, and the second part is performance. And performance is what is used to be in the 19th century. It's a public performance in theaters, but also it applies today to any online service, as Alexander explained, from streaming to downloading. But it means that we have not changed our rules, and today the rights which have been assigned 100 years ago to a publisher, mechanicals, and performance are still managed the same way as 100 years ago.
For anyone who doesn't know, you know, here in America we have the two different copyrights, one in the musical composition and one in the recording, and it's the same. The rights are split in a similar way in Europe, although they're called different things. But for following the conversation, it's important to keep the distinction in mind. Lee, are there other distinctions you'd like to draw between the rights as they've been described and what we typically experience here?
Well, we could probably fill the whole panel up just by talking about the distinction between the rights. I guess a couple of just high points, you know, without diving deeply into it. A lot of the rights that we're talking about here, it's really, to a large extent, a distinction only in semantics. The idea is, you know, whether you're in France or continental Europe and you're talking about neighboring rights or related rights, or you're in the UK and you're talking about an actual mechanical, it's still essentially the case that a United States service trying to license their operation in Europe still has to license, depending on obviously what they're providing, You still have to license a mechanical if you're engaging in downloads. You still have to license a performance if you're engaging in streaming. And for many of these territories, you actually have to license both no matter what you're doing. Going beyond that, just for another second, it gets very, very complicated because the rights are all talked about differently. And in fact, when you go and look at them specifically, they have a slightly different scope in continental Europe than they do in the UK, and then again than they do in the United States. But largely, the rights that need to be licensed are across the board the same, although you get them from different parties.
Well, not only are the rights in Europe different, but also how they're managed and who you go to obtain the rights is very different. Here in the U.S., I think most of us understand when you go to a record label, when you go to a music publisher, when you go to a PRO, and it depends a lot on what type of service you have and what the functionality is. And also we have compulsory licenses here, and we know when something falls under the compulsory license under U.S. law or when voluntary licensing is needed. How is the management of the rights different in the UK and in continental Europe?
So taking the recording rights, first of all, perhaps I should say first of all that there is a complete division between music publishing rights on the one hand and recorded rights on the other. The two never meet. Unlike in the United States, you never get a case of record labels bringing with them a license of publishing rights to join in. The rights are obtained from two separate industries. So first of all, taking the recorded music industry, the opportunity for collective licensing is limited. The collective licensing body is Phonographic Performance Limited, PPL. PPL is traditionally a radio and broadcast licensing body. Its mandate to license anything more exciting than direct linear broadcast is limited, and that's because the labels jealously guard those rights as their own, and they don't want to place them in the hands of PPL for many reasons, one of them being that once they're in the hands of PPL, they're subject to the jurisdiction of the Copyright Tribunal in the UK, which is the equivalent of the Rate Court here in the United States. But PPL can license, as I said, linear broadcast. About as exciting as it gets is what we call customized radio. In other words, we're talking Pandora. So if Pandora comes to the UK, finally, it is, in theory, able to get a blanket license from PPL for its service. But anyone offering a download service, an on-demand service, or any kind, is faced with going direct to the record labels for direct licenses, which are freely negotiated. But at least they will be on a pan-European basis and possibly on a further worldwide basis. All the majors do it differently. And for the independents, you go to an organization called Merlin, which is a collective licensing agency for most of the independents, apart from those who regard themselves as mini-majors. Turning to the publishing side, that's where the problems start, if you like. It's much more difficult on the publishing side. The days were, as Jeff described originally, when you went to each territory and you went to the collecting societies in each territory and you picked up your national license for that territory. That was blown apart after Santiago and Barcelona were found to be anti-competitive. And as we know, we've got the major publishers extracted their online rights from all the collecting societies and placed them exclusively with their chosen society. So Universal chose SACEM in France, much to the disgust and disappointment of PRS, who felt like, you know, the party was over. Sony, ATV, went over to Germany. PRS again feeling a bit left out here. Warner Chappell, at least, chose PRS as one of an available range of societies, and EMI then set up that joint venture with GEMA. So you were able to pick up your pan-European blanket licenses for those Anglo-American catalogues from those four collecting societies, but you still have to go around the local territories to pick up the remainder of the licenses for the non-major repertoire. So you're still faced as a DSP with going to CI in theory, although the recent development is Armonia, which is a confluence of SACEM, SAGAI in Spain, SPA in Portugal, CI in Italy, now Sabam recently in Belgium, and also very recently Artijus in Hungary. And it's effectively a single point from which you can get the repertoire of all those national societies in under one, not under one license, but under one system of negotiation.
Yes, as I explained, we have two different types of rights, and I think they are managed relatively similarly as they are in UK, because for the neighbouring rights, the rights of the performers and of the record labels, there is no collective management or very limited collective management. In fact, it's limited to broadcasting, and when we say broadcasting, we mean broadcasting, which means that it doesn't extend even to webcasting. Webcasting is, well, has started to be collective managed, but it doesn't extend to what you call, I don't remember, what we call semi-interactive webcasting, which would be Pandora. Pandora won't be able to have a single license in France and will need to have a license from each record label. We have a second issue. We have four collecting societies for neighboring rights in France, two for producers, one for the majors and other related labels, and one for independents, and two societies for the performers. And there are several disputes, and the musician union is challenging the assignment of the rights to the record label. So there have been cases going on for a long time. But today, it should be said, when you have a service to launch in France and generally in Europe, for the record rights, you have to deal directly with a record label or with Merlin or with Believe in France, with one of these aggregators. Then for the author's right, you have one single society, SACEM, for the performance, SDRM for the mechanicals, controlled by SACEM, and SESAM for the online rights, also controlled by SACEM. And SACEM grant one of the differences also in France and generally in Europe is that the rights, personal rights of the authors are assigned to the publisher but are also assigned to the collecting society. So when you are an author member of SACEM, you will have assigned the mechanicals and the performance rights worldwide for the duration of copyright to SACEM, which means that SACEM has really the power to represent any French author and to represent any French publisher, even if a French publisher or a major would withdraw their catalogues, and SACEM would still have the direct assignment from the authors, which means that SACEM is in a position to negotiate and give licenses for all the rights. SACEM has, as Alexander explained, started to develop a hub with other Southern Europe societies, Italy, Spain. I don't know if Belgium is a South Europe society. Hungary. And, it's certainly something which will develop. But today, SACEM represents the French catalogue for any type of use.
Can you discuss the development of joint licensing? Here in the States, on the musical work side, we go to the PROs for the performance rights, and then we go to Harry Fox or the publishers for the mechanical rights. Are the rights separated and licensed by different entities similarly in Europe?
Well, they're not. And that's a largely, I suppose, it's an accident of history to some extent. But I think the wise guys, the collecting societies, said, well, listen, it doesn't make sense to start having technical arguments about whether or not an exercise of the mechanical right or the communication of the public right is taking place here. Why don't we just call it one single lump sum royalty for all the rights you need? And that's because effectively the value of the musical copyright in a stream or in a download is whatever pence it is. And we don't need to get into argument about what rights we have. So, for example, MCPS and PRS in the UK are technically separate organisations managing, on the one hand, mechanical rights and, on the other hand, public performance rights. But all intents and purposes, they license together on a joint basis so that it's not to create difficulties. And it's the same is true with SACEM. But it's different on the continent because, as Eric has said, on the continent, songwriters assign both rights to the collecting society. In the United Kingdom, songwriters assign only the public performance right to the society, to PRS, and the mechanical rights go to the publisher, who then society acts as an agent for the publisher for mechanical rights. It's just a different way of organising
it. So the mechanical rights and the performance rights both get to the society.
They get to the society through a different route. They get to the society through a different route.
That's what I was kind of just kind of observed that one way or another, I look at it this way, a key distinction for those of you who are whatever trying to divine this, some of the important distinctions between European and U.S. law on these things, and those of you who represent services who may be wanting to launch in various European territories. I kind of look at it as two axes on a graph, right? In the United States, by virtue of the, you know, our homogenized, you know, single, it's a large marketplace, but it's a single market in terms of the legalities and the way you license it. We have an interesting kind of separation of the rights. You have to go to the PROs for a public performance. You have to go to Harry Fox or the owners of the publishing rights for the mechanical. And those aren't collectivized. And that's one of the things that we've been working hard to try to accomplish here in the United States. And we just haven't been able to do it yet. But the good thing is you have relatively few entities that have those rights. You just have to go a bunch of different places for the different rights. So let's say that's, you know, the whatever the XY axis and the AB axis is represented by Europe, where you have, to a large extent, you have collectivization of the administration of the rights, right? So as Alex was saying, you can go to PRS for music or MCPS PRS, and you can get all of the rights you need. But the problem is, and we'll talk about where this is going in a second, you can only get those for either a particular territory or a particular group of territories, and whether or not they're reciprocal and to what extent they're reciprocal is problematic. So it's really kind of interesting. They, at least from my perspective, in Europe, there's been a large move within each individual territory to kind of say, let's stop these arguments about exactly what right is implicated by this particular service, especially digital services. You can wrap all those rights up for that service, at least in this territory, at least right now. Here in the United States, we still have those turf wars. It's still very much a concern whether or not what you did was a download or a stream or it was interactive or it was highly interactive, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the way I look. I don't know if I actually did a good job of explaining that, but they collectivize a lot. We don't collectivize a lot, but we have one big territory where all the rights ultimately are available, and they have a lot of territories, and they're trying to now collectivize the territories as well as the rights.
I would say that yes, the issue of definition, is it mechanical or is it performance, has some importance for the right holders, for the publishers and the writers, because the share of performance are statutory defined by the bylaws of the societies in Europe. In France, it's 1/3 for the publisher, 2/3 for the authors and composers. And the share for the mechanicals is determined by the contract. Usually it's 50%, but you may have contracts where the publisher has 90% and the writer 10%. So it's important when a deal is made that SACEM defines precisely how the rights will be shared between the publishers and the writers. And for instance, the SACEM had considered in the past that for downloading it was 50-50, and it has changed this year. SACEM considers today that it's 10% for performance, 90% for mechanicals, because it will indeed increase the share of the publisher and decrease the share of the writers and composers.
So for the music publishing rights in Europe, do you always go to the societies or do you ever go directly to the publishers?
You go direct to the societies at the moment, although if you... The negotiation will inevitably, when it comes to the major label Anglo-American catalogue, it will inevitably involve the publishers. And in fact, if you want, rather particularly if you want Warner Chappell, which you have to have obviously, you will actually be dealing direct with Warner Chappell. And the license will simply be issued and managed by your choice of society, whether it's PRS or STIM. So the answer is, for the Anglo-American major label catalog, major publisher catalogues, you're dealing very closely with the publisher. For the rest, you're dealing with the societies.
And I think, you know, one thing that comes out of what Lee said about the collectivization of the rights, we're always focused here about the splits on particular songs. And you can have a song with many different publisher owners. And how do you identify them and how do you go and license all of the splits on a single composition? But my understanding is that in Europe, you don't really focus on that issue. You have big repertoire groups that are licensed from different organizations, but you don't have splits on particular compositions where you have to worry about coalescing all of the rights on a track.
We do. I would say the majority of copyrights are split, and I did a little survey on this the other day. I looked through Music Week at the top 20, and the average number of publishers on the tracks in the top 20 was 5. So it is the commonplace. It's the standard is multiple co-owners, co-writers. And it's something to my mind that the European Commission has never really understood. In trying to improve the state of European licensing, the Commission has been obsessed with the idea of multi-territory licensing. And in doing that, it has rather lost sight of the fact that it's fine if you get a multi-territory license from EMI, but frankly, it's a fat lot of good because 90% of the EMI copyrights are co-published by another publisher as well, and you still can't move until you have a license from all the other co-publishers. And it's this re-aggregation of the rights that's the most important thing, not the multi-territory licensing. I don't think the Commission's ever really understood that.
But just to be clear about it, if you have multiple owners of a single song, in the States we have to go and get a license from each of those owners, and in Europe, if you have rights from the collective society, from all the appropriate collective societies, you will have aggregated all the rights on that song.
If you have
one contract, but as you said, we have two types of contracts today. We have a multi-catalog but national licenses, where you will go to a national peer collecting society. You will have a contract. Today, if you are an online service provider, the society will not give you the contract without first calling, in the case of SACEM, they will call PRS. You know, if PRS agrees, they will call Warner Chappell, they will call Sony ATV, BMG. Today, to sign a local online license, you need the approval from 15 societies or companies worldwide. And then, if you want a pan-European license, then you will need 27 licenses from those 27 national collecting societies, plus 10 licenses from the publishers who have withdrawn their rights from ASCAP or from the Mexican society. So for the Anglo-American repertoire and for the Spanish-American repertoire, you will need contracts with 10 different publishers worldwide. So if a work is co-published by five publishers, you will need five different licenses. And then the societies will have to share the rights they collect between them, knowing that you may have five publishers, but you may have in Europe 50 such publishers. If each publisher has published to a different entity, which will be the case for most of the independent producers, publishers. So it's a nightmare today for society to determine exactly the income attributable to a work and what is the share which has to be paid to each right holder.
But just in case we don't point it out at some point, I think it's worth saying that this, all we've been talking about, applies to music services. The way audiovisual services, the music in audiovisual services, Netflix, Love Film, Apple Video, that's done differently because the societies say the management of music in audiovisual products is very, very difficult, and that is done on a national basis still. So you get PRS, for example, will issue one license to any audiovisual service for the whole of the UK, all the repertoire aggregated into that license, blanket, and then the same will be true for SACEM.
Right. It's not just totally, because the license with YouTube is for not only for the French.
But that will include music video. That's because there's so much music video.
Yes.
Sorry, you're absolutely right. When it comes to music video, you go back to the music.
Yes.
The system we've been talking about.
Yes, yes. Right.
Well, you referred a moment ago to the pullouts by publishers, and we had a very noteworthy case here in the States this week involving Pandora and the pullout of Sony ATV and the other publishers and the Judge Coates ruling on that. Obviously, that's U.S. law and U.S. practice, but I'm wondering what you think of that as far as what, if anything, it tells us about the European experience and the types of pullouts and the differences between what you experience and what we have.
Well, I'll talk about that because it's very relevant to the forthcoming future in Europe, which will be dictated by the Collective Rights Management Directive, which is currently going through the approvals process and is likely to be finally approved by early spring next year. And this directive is really an attempt to clean up collective licensing in Europe, on the one hand. And secondly, it's an attempt to make licensing for licensees easier. I think it's an interesting directive for rights holders, that's music publishers. It's excellent, because what it does is it says, you guys are in charge, you can do anything you like. You can place any rights you like with any society you choose, wherever you are and wherever that society is. You can take and you can withdraw rights. You can withdraw rights to certain types of songs. You can withdraw some of your catalogue, but not all of it. I mean, it's superb. But you're looking at it from the other end of the telescope. How does that help fragmentation? It can only make it worse. On the one hand, the directive is saying, hey, we're here to make licensing easier. And on the other hand, it's encouraging an even greater degree of fragmentation than exists at the moment. The other part of the directive is about controlling the governance and organisation of collecting societies, which must be good, and there are plenty of provisions which require total transparency, both for rights holders on the one hand and for licensees and prospective licensees on the other, so everyone can see what's going on. There are obligations to report annually, for example, to make a full report available on the society's website to all in general, all in sundry, for 5 years each year. So everyone knows exactly what's going on, what repertoire is being handled, what monies are coming in, how much the directors are being paid, and so forth. And that's got to be good, because that will solve the problem that exists, not obviously in the United Kingdom, where we all behave ourselves, and in France, but one or two societies who remain nameless. Although I do remember someone telling me at one society where the police came and arrested everyone apart from the receptionist because they couldn't actually pin anything on her. The rest of them...
Right. Am I allowed to ask a question, Joe?
Absolutely.
So, Alex, I was in listening to you talk, I was thinking, you know, you were talking about how you feel like the directive, to a large extent, is kind of empowering the rights holders and the societies that collect for them. Do you see the recent CISAC decision as also doing the same? Because I kind of looked at that and I thought to myself, the decision, as much as it's encouraging pan-European licensing and cooperation amongst the societies, it largely went to announcing that the behavior that the collecting societies had engaged in up until that point was not anti-competitive, was okay, and all those things like the terms of the reciprocal agreements, the way the pricing was arrived at, et cetera, was okay. Do you see that? I mean, am I hearing from you, looking at the whole thing, that maybe what we're seeing in the EU is kind of this continuing empowerment of the collecting societies and the rights holders?
I think if you're talking about the CISAC decision very recently,
yes,
the EBU, it was quite a technical point about whether or not the decision about whether or not there had been collective agreement to agree multi-territory provisions in every single reciprocal agreement. Was there evidence that that was actually a collective decision or not?
Right.
That was the question in that case.
Right.
And the court made it very clear that the Commission had made it very clear that the presence of these provisions in themselves in the reciprocal agreements isn't a problem. It's the fact that there was a collective, a concerted approach to having them in every single agreement that was the problem in that case. And the court found that actually there wasn't sufficient evidence on one of those points. Very technical decision. I think the more important point is that the provisions relating to collective licensing are really a free-for-all now. There can be no exclusivity except, and importantly, that, for example, Universal Music is still entitled to exclusively place its Anglo-American catalogue with SACEM. That continues to be allowed. But in every other sense, when it's collecting society to collecting society, reciprocity, none of those agreements can be exclusive.
Right.
Well, I'm not totally sure that the agreement may not be exclusive. I think today, if we come back to 2005, there was this recommendation by the Commission to modify the rules, and as a consequence, EMI has created CELAS and so on. So there was this move from the publishers, and I think today we won't change the situation, and the directive will give an okay to this move. Today it's clear that the catalogue which are managed directly by the publisher will remain managed by the publisher, that they will choose their collecting society. As you said, Universal is with SACEM. They may be with PRS next year. They will, we will have the same type of negotiation as we had in the past. Then we have the issue of the representation agreement. I think the decision of the European Court allows exclusive representation agreements. Then, will it be the case? It won't be the case between the large societies, because the large societies have decided to develop their own hubs, and I do not see SACEM agree with PRS on exclusive license agreement. Nevertheless, it's not impossible that it will be the case with the smaller societies, and that we may have this type of agreements, on a non-generalized basis. I think the issue with Santiago was that there was a single standard license agreement applied by all the societies. And what is very strange for a lawyer is that when you have an agreement between societies saying you have to use this standard agreement, the Court of Justice has decided that there was no concerted agreement, that it was just a fair decision from each society to decide to sign that type of agreement. I think this is the reason why this decision is on very precise issues, but this decision is also a condemnation of the position taken by the Commission in 2004 and 2005. But I think it's too late to think that we will be able to come back to centralized licensing.
But it's just on your point, there's also the directive also says that publishers can license direct as well if they want.
Yes. So things certainly could be different in the future than they are now.
It could be.
We're going to open it up to questions in just a minute or two, but I wanted to ask one last thing before we do. You know, when you look at the licensing that's going on recently, you see YouTube is not launched in Germany. They're going before the Copyright Tribunal. They are live in France and in other countries. We have tribunals in some countries, not others. How does that affect the launch strategy of services as they consider you growing in the European market?
Well, we have a tribunal, obviously, in the UK. There aren't that many countries with a same tribunal. Germany, I think, is... You don't have a tribunal, do you, in France?
No.
So Germany, I think, is the only other one. And I suppose if there is a comfort there for licensees, it is that there is a knock-on effect of there being a tribunal. I mean, not only can they go to the tribunal, obviously, if they have an issue about a rate, but that's not easy, and nor is it cheap. But there is a sort of knock-on effect that the fact that the tribunal has been there for many years making decisions, that it has arrived at a series of rates across a series of types of service, so there are independently determined benchmarks across the industry, and that does help, I suppose, give a degree of comfort to a licensee that they're working in a marketplace with some form of independent arbitration on what is a fair rate. And I often find myself advising clients that, well, although we can't tell precisely what the rate is, it's going to fall somewhere between that arbitrated rate for that type of service and this rate for this service.
I think just to add on to that from the U.S. perspective, I think for a lot of services, the issue is not that they don't want to approach these territories and not that they don't want to secure the rights and launch legitimate services, but it's just too difficult based on a lot of the stuff that we've kind of dredged up during this conversation. And so what you see is typically it's very, very large companies or companies that have just gotten a large infusion of capital that decide to actually go out there and tackle these issues. Smaller companies that are still trying to, you know, actually put themselves in a profitable position on their P&Ls domestically here in the United States have a hard time looking at the European licensing landscape and saying that the return on investment for going into that arena and trying to secure all of those licenses through all of those different territories is probably, the ROI on that it probably doesn't justify the effort. And hopefully a lot of the things that have been talked about recently, including the directive and the result of the CISAC decision, will allow, and also, by the way, some of the voluntary things like the ICE arrangement and Armonium will allow Europe to kind of coalesce into, if not one single licensing hub, then at least a couple of significant licensing hubs, so that services that you people either work at or represent or whatever can look across the Atlantic and say, okay, there's one or two or three places that I can go, and I can reasonably be assured that I'm going to be able to blanket that territory, and I can launch my service safely without a huge potential liability there. But right now, it's just not there. But hopefully things like Armonium and ICE and some of these decisions will help.
I would say that it's not so difficult to have licenses in Europe and in France. As in France, we have no copyright tribunal, but SACEM is in a monopolistic position, which means that apply exactly the same rate to all any competitor. So if you go to SACEM, the rates are published, and you know exactly the price which will be paid for a simple service, be it streaming or downloading. Pandora will have exactly the same rate as Spotify or Deezer. Then you have more sophisticated services such as Apple or YouTube, and indeed you will have a negotiation. But it's, I would say, relatively easy. And one of the issues, I think, there has never been a case introduced by SACEM against a service provider wanting to develop a service in France. If you come to France, you go to SACEM, they will explain how it works, they will make proposal, and I have clients, American clients, who have signed their agreement 3 or 4 years after launching the service. They have just paid what they are due to pay, but had absolutely no risk. And there is also no risk because in Europe, there is no statutory damage, no punitive damages, which means that if SACEM goes to court or PRS goes to court to ask for, and introduce an infringement case, the type of damages they will obtain is a royalty which is due, plus the cost, and the cost of a case in France is not very high. So I think it's relatively easy, and also, as I explained, when you have a national license, even with SACEM, SACEM will call PRS, GEMA, the publishers. As a US service provider, you will have contact with a US publisher, and when you come to Europe, it's relatively easy to develop the licenses.
So no punitives, no statutory damages. Yes. Viva la différence.
Not good work for the lawyers.
Same in the UK.
That's right. So we wanted to open it up to questions. Do we have any in the audience? Yes, Joe.
Two quick questions. Eric, in terms of the multi-territory licenses that are issued by the likes of CELUS, SACEM on behalf of Universal, am I right that the territories are sort of coextensive with the EU? In other words, CELUS doesn't license into, say, Russia or Eastern Europe, doesn't license into Asia or any other territory. Is that right? For the Anglo-American repertoire?
CELUS doesn't. But SACEM does, doesn't it? Its licenses go beyond Europe.
For Universal, probably not.
Not for Universal, but for the SACEM.
For SACEM, for instance, a contract with YouTube applies to 180 countries. Wow. So it's a worldwide license, with the exception, I think, of China and some Asian countries.
Okay, and the follow-on question, Eric had mentioned performers' rights, and just reminded me again about the difference with the moral rights scheme in Europe. When, for example, PPL issues a license to Pandora for the collective licensing of sound recordings, does that include a performer's piece? In other words, does that take care of any performer's moral rights? And same in France?
No, the PPL license does not include performer's rights. When I saw my very first PPL license, I said, this isn't good enough, it doesn't give me any performer's rights. And they said, we can't grant them to you. So it is one of the great gaps in licensing, is that you just have to assume and expect that the performer will go along with the reality is that the performer has already granted those performer's rights to the label.
And so the label can...
The label does not... There is a gap in the process, so the label does not pass those rights on to PPL such that PPL can include them in a grant of a PPL license. So you have to take some comfort from the fact that performance rights, to the extent they're assignable, they're not all assignable, to the extent they're assignable, they are invariably assigned to the record label. And that is the best comfort you'll get.
So there is, said another way, is there some risk of performers bringing a cause of action, for their sort of economic interest, if you will, under the equivalent of a PPL type license?
Well, the performer is only entitled. The performer has a in England. The performer has a statutory right to equitable remuneration on a broadcast, and they do receive that money. But that entitlement doesn't exist for the on-demand services.
Okay. And is the same true in continental Europe?
So in continental Europe, and at least in France, we do not have collective management for the recording rights, with the exception of broadcasting. For broadcasting, it's a fair remuneration. There has been an agreement to extend collective management to webcasting, but not to any interactive service. So Pandora won't have a possibility to have a collecting agreement. They have to negotiate with each label. And then your second question, as I said, you have in France two collecting societies representing performers. And the collecting society representing musicians has sued Apple and the six major downloading services in France, claiming that the musicians have assigned their rights for physical products, but not for downloading, not for digital rights. And we obtained last week six decisions from the Supreme Court squashing this demand and saying that when a musician took part to a recording in the 70s, he accepted that this recording was exploited as a physical product, but also as download, as the economical value of the download was exactly the same as a sale of a product. So today, at least for downloading, we have obtained this, this decision from the Supreme Court, which doesn't mean that Speedydam, this society, may not introduce the case for streaming, because streaming is not equivalent to a sale, and it's a service, and the solution may be different.
Thank you.
With no statutory or punitive damages, what's the incentive to get a license at all? I mean, why don't you just wait for the rights owners to come after you and then pay what they say you owe them, and it's cheaper, easier, streamlined approach?
I think it's difficult for a large company to explain publicly that they refuse to pay authors and artists. So I think it's easier. For instance, Apple in France has challenged the private copy levy, because there is no author in front of you, but they do not challenge SACEM's rate, because it would be very difficult to explain that they refuse it. And also, yeah, there may be a criminal liability of the managers of the company. Very theoretical, but nevertheless, if I explain that to the president of a U.S. company, he will certainly consider that he won't take that risk.
Just, I suppose, a correction, really. There are punitive damages in the United Kingdom. There are no statutory damages. So if you were, for example, to launch a service and make absolutely no attempt to get in touch with any of the rights holders, the court certainly would be looking to for an award of punitive damages. We don't call them punitive damages. We call them various things, but they're the same. They amount to the same thing. And the award would be for the royalty to be payable plus a hefty percentage more.
Plus attorney's fees.
Plus your attorney's fees.
All costs, right?
I think we have time for one more. Debbie.
This is a little back in the weeds. This kind of refers to something we were talking about. So, you know, in the U.S., when you're doing licenses for digital music service, you have basically two categories in a way: interactive or non-interactive. You have DMCA compliant non-interactive, and then you have all forms of interactive. You know, 10 rates, Mary Fox, different kinds of bundles and subscriptions and lockers and all that stuff. It is so complex. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that in the UK and the EU, as streaming is picking up steam, that it's still basically a download and a stream, and you're not distinguishing between the low level of interactivity, how many skips you can have, how long it can be cached or tethered, you know, on a portable device. Is it basically just two categories, streaming and downloading, or are you breaking streaming up into the level of interactivity?
There are divisions, perhaps not so many. I mean, there are divisions that appear on a commercial level, really. In other words, the royalty rate's different. So you get streaming rate, you get an on-demand streaming rate, temporary download rate, permanent download rate. That's on the publishing side. When your record label license arrives, you can have anything up to 15 different rates for a single service, because there may be 15 different ways you can access that service, and it'll be dependent on which subscription you're applying or whether you have a pack or a promotional pack. There could be many. So yes, on a commercial level, there are plenty of divisions. On a legal level, there aren't any. It's all exactly the same. It's an exercise of the communication to the public right and the mechanical right.
Well, we've tried to shed some light on these issues today for you, and even though there's been a lot of fragmentation of the rights, it's also clear there's an emerging trend to re-aggregate. And while it remains a licensing labyrinth, as Eric stressed, it is possible to get the deals if you know where to go and what to do. I'd like to thank our panelists. The IAL is very pleased to have been able to do this with the Copyright Society. Thank you all so much for coming.